criteria for the, I can speak from some experience as a business agent for the Carteners in Fairbanks, in that when they first started writing hiring halls, the work history, the registration thing, it's possible the guy worked the preceding 2 years in the area, and that's the only place he worked. He may or may not have listed the anchorage for his residency. And I don't know what the percentage or Fairbanks, and it maybe did come in and go out. Maybe that's how some of this goes. And the others, as I pointed out, they don't answer the calls. It's a variable thing, and I think the important thing is from here forward. But there is no easy answer, and you can talk to each business agent, and they feel they've done a good job of dispatching them out. You get various percentages as to what's actually on the line, and I don't know. Maybe if some guys resent answering, for instance, I was in a conversation, a guy asked me where I was from, I said Iowa. Well, I haven't been from Iowa for 23 years, but, and that really wasn't what he meant. He said, do you live in Anchorage? And I said, yeah. But I don't know if you get that kind of response from a guy on the line or what. I'm not happy, and I don't think any union rep here, when you hear a percentage of 40% within any craft, whatever it is, of being an outsider.
But that's my point, Wayne. I look upon all of the paper papers and the union representatives, and many of the contractors in Alaska, and it would seem to me that they have shared the same views and philosophy that all of us do. But somewhere I also heard in the last 2 days from, I don't know if the contractors would like to reiterate this or not, that already the turnover rate out there on that line is over 100%.
I can't answer that. The contractor's the one that should be able to tell you exactly what that is, and I can't answer it. That's going to be one of the problems, and one of the things we haven't talked about in the resident hire thing, is if the resident works his way up, gets out on the job, through, say, 150, 200, and to use a craft, and then he, for some reason, leaves after 2 or 3 weeks, does he come back and immediately go to work again ahead of the others? There's this kind of a problem, too.
Well, your business agent behind you, I realize you haven't been dispatching lately, Dwayne, but there are many other business agents here that actually, do they have any keys to this?
Has anybody got it?
I wanted to say a while ago anyway, give you my address and everything after I get through. For some reason or other, we had a confusion on that, but the way I worked it is if the contractor runs a man off, or if he quits, then I will usually put him out, because I don't have that much work going now anyway. I usually put him out with another contractor. But if he, say he's terminated for getting drunk and not showing up to work, they usually give him 3 days to take care of his business, to get back the phone, call him, do something, tell him whether they're going to go to work or not. If they're sick, then they got no problem. But if they are terminated for drinking, they don't show up, in other words. Or they get run out of the camp for some kind of reason. I won't send them back to the same contractor, but I have been putting them out. In other words, I haven't been going out and picking up another, say, a local hire man. I take out so much money each week. And while I'm here, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I am considered by my international as a Alaska union. I first came up here in 1967 and have communicated back and forth, My address in Fairbanks is 2006 Southern Avenue, or the Polaris building where I have an office there also. Did that clear up on my part as far as the dispatching?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to know if there was the turnover rate, how is it great already?
Percentage-wise, Representative Bowman, I don't think I've got that big a percentage of turnover, although I do have quite a bit of a drinking problem. And for the benefit of our, I got one too. And for the benefit of our natives, believe me, it's not all natives. It's some of my own people. They've been terminated too for the same problem.
Hey, if you care to respond to that, your union is based on a high turnover.
Mr. Bowman, we are not at this time, I'm really not prepared to even give you an answer to this fact. The only way I could answer it would be to say, well, how is our dispatching moving? We send out 300 and we get 150 back. That doesn't mean just on the pipeline. That's other contractors also. I mean, it's road contractors and it's the whole thing. I venture to say that on the pipeline that we probably have in the neighborhood of a 15% turnover. I hope that it's not higher than that. I'd like to leave this with you. If you're going to see a lot of people on the pipeline, the operating engineers are not going to be resident Alaskans, because would you believe it or not, we only have 4 side boom operators in the entire state of Alaska. Only 4. Last week I cleared 12 side boom operators into Alaska. And these were brought in by the contractors. The people that worked for the contractors previously, we didn't have them. We learned the same thing in hydraulic backhoes. And on a lot of the equipment that we operate, there is not sufficient people in Alaska that can qualify for that. There's not enough people in the state of Alaska that's qualified in our organization and the entire state to do the first section of the pipeline out of Bellevue.
Well, then in that case, you agree with the contractor that we're already out of them.
We need heavy duty mechanics, and I'm talking about mechanics that can go out there in the field and repair the heavy construction equipment. We need them now. I told the people with the Federation of Natives, and this can be verified by them. If you've got people, tell me about them. Let me know about them. I want to know.
Well, why don't we have an OJT program in that regard then?
Well, I'd like to tell you that we're working on one at the present time, and we've just about got it wrapped up. I was looking at a time target of about May 1st, where that we will be getting all of the information that we possibly can from every source between now and May the 1st, from every source in Alaska that we can possibly get, where we can go into the field and we can send evaluating team into the field, all the way from Ketchikan to Nome to Kotzebue to Bethel to everywhere, that there are people that we can talk to.
Well,
and this thing is,
we got a figure here earlier from Mr. Jackson that they have a bank of over 5,000.
Well, this doesn't mean those people are operating engineers that can even qualify.
I don't mean that. But somewhere in that figure, there should be some that could be qualified.
We're going to talk to him. We certainly are. Anybody. I've even got a deal working with the National Guard now trying to get people. I'm begging for people.
Well, I'm trying to reach
Alaskan.
Couldn't we have foreseen some of this? Even though I agree and you agree, we could have. Where do we break down and who caused the breakdown?
I don't know who caused the breakdown. I can tell you that I talked about it 4 years ago. I told them what they were going to run up against. Helen Marsh and Angus can tell you, and other people probably sitting in this audience can tell you, that I talked about it 4 years ago. We have a training program in operation at the present time, and we have approximately 106 people. Alaska residents as apprentices.
In all phases of operating engineering.
Right. We've only had that in effect for a year now.
What's the length of the training?
6,000 hours. That is Person can get it in less than that time, less than, I'd say you get about $2,000 a year, but we can move that man up the ladder. But it's an apprenticeship program under the Bureau of Apprenticeship Training on the U.S. Department of Labor.
Mr. Chairman, if I continue, Swain and others in the apprenticeship of trade, is it possible that we could look at capitalizing or shortening training, regular apprenticeship training? I realize this is a little tough question I'm asking you, but because of the dire need for training people, is it possible that we can capitalize the regular 4 or 5 year or number hour training to take advantage of the people that are wanting to go to work?
Well, all of the trades vary a little bit in the time limit, but these have stood the true test of I don't know how many years on the apprenticeship program. My answer to you would be that no, we'd be very, very reluctant. These standards are adopted, approved on the federal level. Normally, the graduate from one of the apprenticeship programs, his lifetime earnings is, besides a doctor and some of the top attorneys, their lifetime earnings will rate right in, and I think to try and compress it for this would be a disservice to the apprenticeship program. My answer to you is they would resist it. Now, that's different than OJT for a lesser thing, but we're not going to upset the apprentice program.
Okay, but you know what that causes? It causes a guy that has some type of training or some type of measurable skill, he will then have to go out into labor, but he's not going to go through the training program where he can go out and make $11,000.
Well, except the Alaska Plan and Equivalency Board is supposed to respond to some of this on a lesser than journeyman, greater than a step in the apprentice training. Some of the trades have taken some of the pressure off by changing their age limit. We were compressed in a minimum age. Some of them have, through their internationals, raised this now. But the equivalency board is supposed to respond to that need in between there, Lord, as opposed to monkeying through the general flow of the apprentice program.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask Junior to come up? Maybe we can get a handle on this equivalency board again. Junior, what does the equivalency board actually do, and what has been the result? You say that you have 38 people, and I don't want to misquote you, maybe you better go over that again, but the 38 people that are qualified.
Yes, some dispatches are here.
Is this all of the people that you checked through your board?
No, Mr. Bowman. Through the chair, we did, as I indicated, take 36 borderline carpenters that the Alaska Federation of Natives had indicated were not at the apprenticeship level, and we ran those people through the panels, and 4 of them did qualify as apprentices and are presently working as carpenters apprentice. The remaining number are, some of them are presently in training programs, and others are awaiting an opening for a training program.
What response do you get when you refer these people to the union?
We have gotten tremendous response from the unions. Our first panel meeting sometime in October, we had one person from the JAR system that we could pull out who happened to be an electrician, and we ran him through the union, through the panel. The panel indicated that he was a journeyman. We took him on that same day to Ike Waldrop with IBEW, and he dispatched him for the next day as a journeyman.
Is he one of those 38?
Yes.
But since last year, you have only qualified 38 positions that are people. Do you think that you've met the requirements or met the need? Or do you see where you might have to meet more regularly? Or are there people out there that are not being qualified in any categories where they could get into apprenticeship training or the OJT?
there are undoubtedly a number of people in such a position. Again, some of the problems we run into is the person's reluctance to appear before such a panel. And I think that if we look at the experience equivalency panel to maximize Alaskan residents for pipeline work, that I may have some technical problems in running all Alaskan residents. We've got to recognize that the Alaska plan was designed for minority manpower utilization, and I think that the technicality can be worked out if we go under the spirit of cooperation that Mr. Carlson's testimony was couched.
Well, Mr. Ringer, I for one would have no objection if you qualified anybody as long as they were the last resident. And I realize you're mandated to work in the minority area.
Did you have anything further, Representative Bowman?
Well, I still have the problem that the contractors have outlined and how we're going to help fill this gap of trying to mesh the people in from outlying areas as far south as Kent can. Do you think it's possible that we can set up an outside safety area? If anyone wants.
This agreement that we've been working on with Alyeska will encompass approximately 300 people. And when we go into the field and we screen these people, we're not talking about the people, we're talking about people over the age of going into the apprenticeship program. We're talking about people 35, 40, 50, 55, I mean, no age limit. Problem? We go into the field, we screen the people, and then we know where those people are at, and then we bring a certain number of them into Anchorage. No cost to the individual. He stays there for 1 week. He goes through a complete course, and then they shift to the various areas out on the job site. Now that'll be approximately 300 people that Alyeska is going to fit the bill on, and I think we run a real fast estimate on it, it'd be well over $1 million. Now that's just for 300, and we don't know how much farther we'll have to go. But those are people that are qualified and have some experience, that at least they know what a piece of equipment looks like. They may have done a little work around their village, or for the FAA, or for somebody, for the mining companies, or whoever it is. Those people are the ones they're talking about. I'm sure that Mr. Lundell can give you a complete rundown of that, what we've done so far. And we have it, I venture to say, in its almost final stages to present to the policy committee to get their okay to go ahead and do it.
And these people will be available by the peak season to be working.
Well, we want to put that many in this year.
Right.
By peak season. Yes.
Representative Eliason.
I wonder, Mr. Chairman, before you ask a question, if I could just expand on this a little bit on our training thing so we don't get off on the wrong track here. There's a concern to build a pipeline with journeyman people. And I think our statute says that we'll get those qualified journeymen out of Alaska if we possibly can. Now, the training programs we're going to have to work out on a little different thing. We need to flow them into the job market, but I'm not sure you can do that under the state law. And I think we're talking about, we need to qualify them, and that's part of the concerns on it. But I think if we're really talking about Title 38 and the journeyman, and that's the guy that we've been talking about, the guy that hasn't been working in the construction industry, he's been working in some other area in the state, who's a qualified journeyman, needs to find a vehicle to get in. We're trying to help him do that. Now, we can't do all things at this one particular meeting, and we're willing to sit down with the vocational ed people. We're willing to sit down with the Employment Security Division on their job surveys through the computer as to what the job needs are going to be in the next 2 years, and then try and get some state money and federal money to train. And that's why we have some of our experts here to talk in the training field if we get into that. But I think we really need to, we have some qualified Alaskans that aren't finding their way into the journeyman, that isn't finding his way up on the slope. And I think our first thing under the state law is to see that this fellow finds his way in. And then we need to address the job training, but I'm not so sure we can do it under that Title 38.
Representative Elias.
That was my question, Dwayne, more or less. What's the union procedure for the local, say, Southeastern local? How do they get trained in this agency without leaving Southeastern or Gulf Coast in Fairbanks or any
Well, I can only comment as a personal thing from observing, sitting over in the IBEW office and listening to telephone conversation between the plumber business agent here and there as to what day they could send those five guys and this type of thing. Their flow there is fairly orderly because they're a smaller group and they don't get the big numbers in. So they've done it there. But they have had, as Mr. Cashin could tell you, a case, I think it was in Ketchikan or Sitka, where because of the time lags getting on airplanes and on the type of day it was, he couldn't get on an airplane. The time he got there, the job had been filled and the guy did have to come back. Those are going to happen regardless of how we do it, if the 48-hour thing is in. But they do it through their local rep and by telephone.
In other words, conceivably, a man would not leave Southeast in order to get on the A-list of Fairbanks, frankly. If it's invasion, would be in contact with the state bank.
This is true in most cases. I can't speak, and you'll have to, if someone has a particular, they'll have to talk to these fellows later. But generally, that's the way it works. For instance, the IBEW, it's no problem. That's a statewide local. If there's some locals who have area jurisdiction they're protecting, that would work a little differently. But the operating engineers and some of the others with statewide locals, we don't have any problem.
Well, where are these large amount of people we hear that are waiting in between the halls of Fairbanks and Anchorage? Are those outside people coming in and trying to get on?
A lot of them are. I haven't been to Fairbanks recently, but we have some people here from Fairbanks. The only thing I can tell is what I see in the paper, and it scares the hell out of me, and I'm glad I'm not in the business, I'll tell you that, because that's got to be a tough to come down there in the morning and face 2,000-3,000 people wanting to go to work, some of them being your own time long resident. But pretty soon it doesn't make much difference. You're facing that guy every morning, he's short, you know, he's got his family with, or whether he does and he's out of door. It's just a tough business, and there's nothing easy about it. And they're wrapped clear around the halls, and of course our social services, everything else. And I'm sure the employer doesn't like them rapping on their door all the time either. It's called for staffing problems. The buildings that used to house two and three local unions together have had to divide out and try and find other ways. As I understand, one of the local unions rented the Oddfellas Hall just to have the out-of-staters go down and wait because there wasn't room for them anyplace else. They're just sitting down there wanting to go to work. Now, we've done everything we know through our international unions to try and discourage this. I don't know of an international union within their publications hasn't put out the word Christ. Don't come up here, though. There isn't the word. But because we got hit right at the wrong time with a tough unemployment situation, and the states are coming anyway, they know that there's going to be X number of jobs opening up, and that's better than none where they're at, so they're going to try and take a chance. But it's really a tough situation, and that's where most of them come from, Dave.
What are the actual mechanics of
That's right.
Mr.
The business agent in Anchorage or Fairbanks will call down to the business agent here, and he says, next Tuesday, send me six carpenters.
Well,
what will come off the
way? We heard this in response.
As to the laborers, at least, I think we can give you a response, which will probably be helpful to you. Some years back, in fact, since we had our exclusive hiring arrangement, we have three locals in Alaska. We used to jealously guard the jurisdiction of each local union for the residents in that area. We shaped our agreement so that the Ketchikan area resident had the first chance at the hours on the list that he worked in that area. We used to have big riots about people coming from Ketchikan or moving from Anchorage to Fairbanks, and the Fairbanks guy was out of work and the Anchorage guy took his job and those things. So we we had that for many years there. Now, anticipating that what we're talking about here, in the last negotiations, we changed our bargaining agreement, the hiring clause, so that our hours for our Alaska laborers that work anywhere in Alaska now count toward getting on the list in any holiday they want to go on, so that our people in Ketchikan, Juneau, where have you, could now register in Fairbanks, and the hours that they have previously worked anywhere in Alaska.
By mail or by phone?
And they can register and re-register by mail, yes.
And call somebody
in
through the hall.
Let me make sure I'm putting that accurately. We can re-register by mail. I think we require the original registration by, well, not for the number that has the hours. That's right. And then he can re-register by mail every 90 days.
Basically,
he
asked if he
could
present that first
registration. No, not if he's transferring from a sister office. While I'm here, I'd like to respond to Senator Kutula, so I'd make sure that he didn't leave any bad impression here. It's true he's been on our list for 20 years, a very small and select list. It's that overqualified list that we've heard about here. We've never been able to find a job for him that paid enough that he'd take.
Okay, I want to point out to the committee members, you know, we've got, there are many, many people here that are going to have to catch a plane, and I feel we should let them leave, you know, get ready to go by 3:45, and that's in 30 minutes. So, if there's, maybe we better start thinking in terms of some of the final questions that you might want to ask of the either labor or the contractors, because the chair does plan to release anyone that has to get out on the plane at 3:45. And then we'll take a little bit of a break and come back into session, and those other folks that want to get on the record will take testimony beyond that point.
Thank you,
Mr.
Representative Chairman McKenna wants a show of hands of those who will be leaving, that have to leave.
There's not that many planes.
There's only one plane. Curtula, you better follow this group out.
Perhaps then, are there any more questions for labor per se?
Andy, would you please give them those apprentice things, and we will have them for all of the legislators to take a look at. I think it's important they do understand the criteria for apprenticeship programs.
Okay. Representing Chairman McKenna does have another question.
Fine.
If the contractor issued a call specifically for residents, say you wanted six residents,
contractors came down from Anchorage.
How would
be here?
The union,
he doesn't need to testify, but he is here in case anybody wants any.
The union requested six residents.
A contractor requested six residents, carpenters or operating engineers or whatever.
I'm assuming you're talking about a pipeline contractor that comes under the purview of the Title 38. We would advise the membership that, first off, he wouldn't have to request six residents.
But under the new regulations, the department's going to be setting.
So I can restate it so you understand it clearly. Every time a call was made by a local union for a dispatch to a pipeline contractor, the local unions will post it in their hiring hall, the requirements for whatever would they come out with, a final residency requirement, if it's 1 year, whatever other criteria. At the time they make the call, they'll also announce you must be a resident to go out. Now, if somebody who is not a resident insists on going, I would assume the union business agent would have to refer him out to wherever their staging area, where the guy once again would have to prove his residency. But they're going to announce it at every call as soon as we get the rigs and everything set up. Now, if another employer from somewhere else called for, you know, six residents, they'd have to say, hey, you know, the referral system may or may not allow that.
Well, referral system allow an employer to give a preference in hiring to a local resident?
Well, there can be a preference of hire. Some, here again, they're all different on request. They wouldn't let you call down and say, because it's not spelled out in an agreement, give me six by whatever criteria.
residency being one. They cannot request on that basis. We can point out the necessity of coming under the law, but we can't arbitrarily dispatch on that basis.
Didn't when Mr. Henderson from the National Labor Relations Board was here, didn't he say that it was his interpretation of the law that unions could dispatch?
No, I think the record will show that what he said, if the union, and I understand one of the unions had some problem with their C list as to how to handle this. If the union and the employer who had the joint agreement sat down and renegotiated the C list, they wouldn't object. Now, that's what I understood him to say. And I think the record will reflect that. It's changing the hiring hall in the middle of the contract, but it's by mutual consent. So naturally, the NLRB is not going to enter into that unless it might. The fear was, if you renegotiated that and you moved some ahead on C list of those who had been on there prior, right in the midterm of a contract, there might be some charges filed. The NLRB felt B&G had done it by mutual consent, probably by ratification of the membership, which is normally necessary, that the NLRB would not hear a charge. He also, right immediately then, said, we can't put that in writing because I could be overridden, you know, which doesn't leave us much way to go.
Okay.
Could I ask Mr. Elliewine just one question? Do you have any idea how many members of the Alaska chapter of AGC are also parties to your Washington agreement?
No, I would assume that there are some, but I wouldn't have any idea who they are. I can guess. Well, there's just no way I can tell. Reflects here is the last chapter.
Chairman McKenna, Mr. Glenzer, administrative assistant for the AGC, is here.
Could I ask him then?
Mr. Glenzer?
Right.
Could you come forward, sir, and
you had a question.
Right, how many members of the Alaska chapter are also members of the Washington chapter and parties to that agreement?
Well, actually it's not quite that simple. There is such a thing as a hometown chapter to which a particular contractor belongs. If he goes to another chapter and does work in that area, he pays particular dues and so forth to that chapter.
I wouldn't call that permission.
He would automatically be signatory to a particular plan, or rather to bargaining agreements if he came into there and was a member of AGC. So if somebody went to Washington, he was a member of AGC, he would be signatory to a Washington agreement.
Do you have any idea?
If he gave them their bargaining.
Do you have any idea how many AGC members are parties to both in Alaska operating engineer contract?
Well, 302 up here is a separate agreement, and our 70, roughly about 70 members, of whom we all have their bargaining rights, are signatory to the local 302 up here. Now, how many of them are actually doing work in Washington right now? I couldn't answer.
Okay. Representative Bowman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, before we break out of here and while we still have the unions and the contractors, it seems to me that it's boiling down to a very simple problem. We have a job pool of jobs coming up on this pipeline, and we have a people pool of people out here somewhere that want to go to work on the pipeline that may or may not have skills. If the state, using the equivalency panels or whatever other method that we can come up with, can find these people and rate them with these panels, what there are moving people on, so that they're able to go into and accept the job out of this pool. If the state puts this money into that, they come out either as apprenticeship or graded or journeyman, would the contractors and the union accept these people?
Well, I can only answer for one segment of it, one half of it, and that's the union section. The part on the apprenticeable thing, we're going to have to separate out again, in that we can only take so many per annum into the apprenticeship programs. And you'd have to talk to Mr. Anderson as to how many applicants you get for each job opening in the apprentice phase. I'm saying to you, though, the journeyman, whether we wanted them or whether the contractor wanted them, if they're qualified and we get them registered in, and the state enforces its law, they're going to go to work. It's just that simple. Now, the key has got to be in registration, and that will help in any way we can. We'll meet with any group. But they just have to find a way to the top if they're qualified, and the state enforces its laws.
Okay, supposing we claim out to do these equivalency panels with X number of journeymen in every craft, you're saying that the union will accept them.
Then they'll refer them out. If they stay on the job, they'll be accepted into the union.
Then I need to have an answer from the contractors. Would you accept these fully qualified journeymen people if they go through the panel? Then is the state willing to put some money into to finding these people?
No.
I'm talking about the Department of Labor.
Commissioner, go designate.
I would ask Mr. Talbot to come up. But I understand that this is the whole purpose of the discussion here, to get these people in the system and get them to work. Mr. Dalby? There's our records man. He has 80-some thousand of them.
I got to hit you with a hard one, people. No. We need statements. Pure and simple. In other words, all of the dollars we get from the federal government cannot be used for this purpose.
Well, I'm not talking about federal money, I'm talking about state money. So maybe we reallocate some money, and I understand this to be the commission's department's number one priority now. Am I wrong?
No, I think that we've asked for some matching dollars for our CEDA program. But this would be over and above that situation.
Okay, but the formula still exists that if you came up with state money and we went out and really did the job on evaluating these people and came up with X number of journeymen and developed this people pool to the extent that we could refer journeymen to the job pool, the state could fund that, the contractors and the union say they would accept it.
I think it'd be a very wonderful program.
Did you see where this might short circuit the whole thing what we're here talking about?
Part of it, yes. Any other questions, panel?
Any other representative?
I have one other question of the union.
Representative Huntington, and then I'll return. Representative
Dwayne,
Huntington.
My problem is that I've got a number of people through my district, and not only my district, I represent all of Alaska, I feel when I step on here, but they have the same problem I have. We don't have the education. We have, I've driven cat for many years and never belonged to the union, and there's many people in the same boat as me. Our problem, we don't have the education. Now, in order to get an application for apprenticeship, high school diploma. How do you get high school and diploma when you don't have first grade education? You know? So there's got to be something developed between a brush-up course, some kind developed between...
Representative Huntington, we do have that, and quite extensive, through the apprenticeship program, Department of Education, and maybe somebody could help me here. Lou, could you tell me how they're talking about getting the GED to get in to the apprenticeship program? But this isn't unusual, and we expend quite a bit of time and effort on doing just that. But the fellow comes in, he has a desire, he meets the age requirements and the aptitude, and then they'll
send him out to school and help him get his equivalency diploma.
There is a system for GED, either through arrangements to adult basic education, and a lot of those programs are run in the villages now by the Department of Education. There is a test, there are a number of test centers throughout the state. In a lot of cases, it's a matter of people being made aware of the fact that there is such thing available and them getting in to get the test taken and get qualified. There's also adult basic education or ABE programs run in conjunction with a number of the training programs. We've worked with some of the unions, and in some cases where they've selected people who doesn't have the high school equivalency, et cetera, we have made arrangements for that adult basic education to take place in conjunction with that. Did that answer the question?
Well, in a way it does, in a way it don't, because I live out there and I haven't heard a hell of a lot about it. Sure hasn't been pushed very hard, I'll tell you that. Otherwise, I think I would have smelled some of it going by.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, we couldn't hear the...
I said that I live out there, and I don't think it's not very popular program or something, because I haven't heard nothing about it, and I haven't heard of it existing. And I certainly would have heard something about it if it was being implemented.
Yes, it's out there. As a matter of fact, I administered that program at one time, and I happen to know that the budget has doubled in that particular area. It wasn't very much to begin with, I'll admit. I happen to know that that budget has doubled in that area almost every year for the last at least 3 years, and I think there's been near $500,000 in adult basic education and GED in just rural Alaska alone. That doesn't sound like much money, but it's that covers a lot of program.
I don't think we'll get on the right track here.
Maybe not.
What I'm looking for is somebody a lot younger than me, but never went to school a day in his life. He's been on equipment. He knows equipment. He runs equipment. He can take one apart and put it back together, but he can't qualify to get a job. He can work for a mining company, or he can work for a field clearance program for the state of Alaska and stuff like that. But he needs a brusher up course is what he needs. This is what I'm looking for him.
Well, those are tough, Mr. Honeygun, and their department has tried to respond to that to some. First off, he would not be eligible for an apprenticeship training program. From there, we'd have to get into an on-the-job training program of some type, and that's really what, maybe you couldn't hear Mr. Bowman down at this end, that's one of his concerns, is how does that fellow really get in? And one is, as Mr. Dalby pointed out, with proper monies, we can find the guy that had the skill level, and as I understood Mr. Jackson from the AFM, they've got 500, I think they felt somewhere, somebody used that figure that was probably ready to go now, and some with less skills. Now those will hopefully surface, and then they can use some of the programs that they've talked about here, 300 trainees in that different level that's too old for the apprenticeship program, but yet not a journeyman, and they have 300 and some trainees now, and the operating engineers that will have, and that's what you're looking at. It's a matter of identifying them, and first off, the pipeline, unfortunately, cannot answer all of the unemployment needs in the state of Alaska, and this is unfortunate. There are going to be opportunities, and we're going to have to continue to train, and we hope out of all of this we'll get into the full-blown training program for the ongoing construction projects around the state. And that we're talking about the construction industry, and we hope that we can work people in that want it. And I know this isn't a good answer, and to those who are out of work, and there just is no easy answer to that, Mr. Huntington. I wish there were, but all I can say to you is that we'll cooperate to the best of our ability, and I'm sure the employers will, and I'm sure you as legislators will, and we'll respond the best we can. We still won't do the total problem, but all I can say to you is we'll do the best we can, and I'm sure that you people will keep prodding to see that we do. That's about all I can say.
Okay, Representative Bowman.
Yes. Now, we heard a Mr. Henderson, I believe, from the
NLRB. Yes, he was. Charles Henderson.
Yeah. Last week or 2 weeks ago, when he left here and went to Anchorage, and I don't know what happened there, when he had a half-hearted agreement that they would not respond favorably to a charge brought if minority hire or even Alaska hire was the union pushed that. Now, do you feel that when a contractor makes a minority call, can the hiring hall procedures be waived as agreed to in Article 7, Paragraph 7 of the Pipeline Labor Agreement?
Well, I think under the federal regulations now, yes, they can. If they're filling a specific request under certain contracts, yes, I think they can. Now, I've got the experts in this field behind me here, and if I'm yet given an answer here, I would hope that we're getting into a real legal area here, and I want to correct one thing. I hope I didn't understand that someone thought Mr. Henderson gave a half-hearted answer about whether he'd prosecute what he would figure an illegal act. That wasn't the impression I had, but the tape I'm sure is available, or the record's available from what he said. I wouldn't want this group to get the impression the NLRB would not. Is that what I understood that to say?
Well, I had, yeah, that we.
No, I mean the question, whoever had the question.
No.
Oh, okay.
That was my comment.
Am I right in that?
Okay. And a contractor can say, I need X number of people, a minority, to bring my quotas or percentages up, and this can be waived in the hall.
In my opinion, is he can. That's exactly why we wrote that provision in the project.
I'd like to add one thing that panel, the Department of Security Division is prohibited by law to accept a discriminatory order.
Well, maybe the state won't accept it, but the union people have just told you we'll waive it and we'll accept it, so.
Well.
Okay.
That's fine. Thanks, Wayne.
Okay. Are there any other questions then of the folks that are going to have to leave here in a few minutes? Okay. Those of you that...
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We want to thank you very much. We want to thank all of you folks that came down to join us in these hearings from the contractor groups, labor groups, and we thank you very much. We'll take about a 10-minute break and then return to the hearing. And we'll proceed with the list that I have here. And then when we get down through the list, if there's anyone else that wants to testify for the record, we'll accept your testimony. And we'll, I was told by the management that we can stay until 5:30, so we're prepared to take testimony until that time, if need be. Okay.
Just a minute. Pardon? The gentleman with the gentleman over there with the glasses that we jumped over before, would you have to come back to him and hold him for a moment?
Spud Williams, would you care to testify now?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Spud Williams, and I work at the Fairbanks Native Association as an employment coordinator for everything north of the 63rd. It's an AFN contract subcontractor to the Fairbanks Native Association. We've had quite a few problems. Our main purpose under the contract was to locate, screen, evaluate, and refer prospective employees from the rural areas of Alaska into the pipeline system or any employment system. And we've found that there's quite a few deficiencies within the employment and training systems that I think need to be corrected. Some of them are not going to be corrected in time to be relevant to pipeline hire, but I think the state should take a long look at their responsibility in the rural areas of Alaska. The state for a long time has run a token employment effort in the bush areas through their outreach programs, hitchhike programs, Job Corps programs and such. But it's been very token. It's been run out of the Fairbanks office, the Anchorage office, the Juneau office. And it's been fairly passive. When this pipeline hit us, there was no way that thing could be utilized to go out there and get the people in the rural areas. And so Alyeska, thank God for this, contracted out to AFN and the Fairbanks Native Association to do this work for the state. And through our efforts now, we've hit almost every village in the state. Took employment forms from anybody and everybody we could find, knocked on doors from house to house in the smaller villages, set up employment centers in the larger villages, left files with the regional people, the village corporations, the chiefs, whoever was responsible in those villages. And we've got a system of muckluck communication now where we can go out there and retrieve these people. The reason we had to do this was because the JAR system that you've designed is totally inadequate to deal with rural people. An urban native is just like trying to grab a hold of a wave in the ocean. They're moving, they're trapping, they're hunting, they're going from Anchorage out back to the village, or Fairbanks back to the village, or people from Southeastern are going back and forth and here and there. And unless you have a contact right in that village, it's almost impossible to find that person. That JAR system has no means of keeping itself up to date. It's mandated that once that person goes to work on the pipeline, this file's inactivated. And once he becomes a union member, he's not going to go back to the state to look for a job. So there's no way to reactivate that file unless he specifically comes to you and says, I'm looking for a job. There's been no system designed to reactivate that file and bring that thing up to date. When you start talking about percentages of Alaskans on jobs, this is very important because you're thinking about utilizing this JAR system. Your percentage of qualified Alaskans, total number of jobs equal resident placement. That won't work through JARs because you know that thing is totally inadequate. There's no way to keep that thing updated. And once they're inactivated, your unemployed labor force in the rural areas will not show up on that system. Because they're going to be union members, they're going to be on the union list, they're not going to be on your JARS list any longer. I think the state should consider contracting this employment service out to the rural areas through maybe the regional organization set up on the Alaska Native Land Claims. It's a natural. They know the people that are out there. They've got daily contact with them. Through the village corporations, through their sub-regional corporations, and hell, 90% of them relate to each other. So they know who's there and what they can do, whether he's a goof-off, whether he's a good worker, whether he's a hard worker, willing worker. We've had very little failure with the people we've brought out of the rural areas because I go talk to people. Is he any good? Is he worth spending the money on to bring in? Will this kid make it through a training program? Or will the bright lights hit him in the eyes and he's going to get drunk and waste our money? Because we've only got so much money to use. And so we want to use it to the best of our ability so we can get the most people into this pipeline. So I think this commission should think of splitting Department of Labor and Employment Services into two divisions. One for your urban areas and one for the rural areas. But let those people being serviced be served by their own people who know them out there. I think the state should take more responsibility. We've heard quite a bit about the union hiring procedures and the union hiring hall practices and things like this. And I know for a fact that the union in the Fairbanks area have really let their ass hang out for suits, bending over backwards to place Alaskan natives. they have to do it on a very token scale because it can't become too obvious what's happening. Because they've got their regular hiring hall procedures to go by. And if the A card members and B card members sitting in those halls seeing too many people going out, even though they're 100% Alaskan residents, you've got problems. So I think the state, like the unions are saying, should take the responsibility of enforcing resident hire. The unions can't do it. Contractors can't do it. It's going to have to be a, just like a policing action. But when they sue a union, it's going to come out of the union's pocket. And so they're not going to do it. I think in our training programs, there's been quite a few deficiencies in some of those programs. I really hate to point any blame on anybody, it's just been a multitude of errors. But last year there was some training programs set up under with the Teamsters. And they were OJT training programs. We had no coordination problems. We had no all dispatch problems because we was able to bring him in a few at a time, 5, 6, 10, 15, get him out the same day. These training programs were union sanctioned and contractor obligated. This means that the contractor said, I will take this many trainees, I will take this many trainees, and it just works smooth. The culinary program runs fairly smooth because it's an open entry, open exit program. That is, people can enter it at any time, exit it when they're ready, when the instructor says they're ready to go. That way you don't get a burst of 40 or 50 people hitting that hall at the same time. A hall with this hiring hall procedures, A, B, C list, cannot take an influx of 40 or 50 people and expect to dispatch them all within a week's time. So you've got to consider the problems of the hiring halls. They're, I think, they are sincere. They are going to try. We had a problem with one hall in town there. They were bending over backwards to help local hire. Some of the members got mad, started slapping suits against them or threatening suits. So they had to close their side doors, so to speak. We call them side doors. They have been up until today. But after the last statement, I think there are no longer back doors or side doors in these halls. Because under the pipeline labor agreement, there was a stipulation. Under these articles, or section 6, article 7, paragraph 7, that said they could waive these hiring hall procedures if a contractor called for minorities to fill his EEO quotas or Alaska Plan quotas. So I think as far as native hire, we will no longer have to call that back door. I think they, with the statement, they've agreed that this is a legal procedure and they're willing to go along with this procedure now. But I think the training programs still have to be designed in such a way that you don't hit that hall with 40 or 50 people at one time. It's got to be open entry, open exit. Because when these people are going to training, they're not all the same skill level. An instructor knows when a student's ready to leave, when he's work ready. So why doesn't he graduate them at a level where he thinks they're job ready? Some students take longer to learn than others. Culinary seems to work very well in this system. A lot of your training programs shouldn't even be institutional training programs. They should be strictly OJT training programs, and this hasn't been stressed enough. I hear the LAS and Bechtel talking about qualified Alaskans, and then we come up with the figures of some of the unions. I think it was stressed the culinary here. Where 50% of the bull cooks were non-resident Alaskans. In other words, the outside contracting companies are bringing up their friends, and their friends are bringing up their friends, and pressures are put on here and there, and they get dispatched. I think if the state would take the responsibility that they say they have the laws for, and enforce those laws, this would never happen. I think the state should design their training programs so that we don't hurt the hall. Try to get along with the unions because they've got just as much problems, if not more, than we'll ever have. Because they've got a system that's developed, and it was developed to help the residents. and we've got to try to cooperate with them as much as we can. But the state's got to take the responsibility to take the burden off of the unions as far as this establishing residency and enforcing residency hire with new contracts. And I guess that's all I have to say.
Questions? Chairman McKenna?
I agree with you that it's going to be left up to the state, and the state's going to have to take a role. Have you had a chance to look at the Department of Labor's new regulation?
No, but I've read the old one. I don't think there's that much difference except for the residence requirements. Is this true?
Basically. I think this set of regulations are a bit stronger than the last one. But I was just wondering if you had any comment on whether or not you thought these would do the job.
I haven't had time for you.
Further questions? Representative Aguirre.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your job.
Employment coordinator for everything north of the 63rd under the Alyeska-FN contract.
Commissioner Arbeck, did you want to comment?
I would like to say something and have Mr. Dolphin.
Okay, would you go then up to the mic?
Chairman McKinnon asked about the regulations. We met with Alyeska, Fluor, Bethel, the ABC, and the unions, and they've asked that we have a session Tuesday afternoon. We think we're going to have the governor's conference room to go over the regulations. They have some changes, so as of now, they're just on standby. But he made a reference to why union members are not in the JARA system. I would like to have Mr. Dalby explain that.
I'd like to go on record that some of the information Mr. Spud Williams had presented toward the panel here is somewhat inaccurate. I would agree that the communication system in the state of Alaska does not reach the entire rural area. I should also go on record that our system called JARS is a new system. It is designed specifically for the urban retrieval, if you will. The Department of Labor Employment Security Division is charged with the responsibility of delivering placements. Our funding basis is placements. 55% of our total market activity, labor activities in the city of area of Anchorage. About 35% in the surrounds of Fairbanks and the balance of the Juneau and southeastern portion. The Federal Manpower Administration is very adamant about the what we call cost effectiveness of their dollars that they give to all states. To add to this, I'd like to say that the only courses that are not open and open exit are those that are conducted in conjunction and are run by the unions themselves with part of our dollars. Another point I'd like to make is that we are upgrading our system constantly. We do keep on record all applications for a 90-day period. Even though the person may go to work, it would be an impossible task to every time a person went to work to follow that person and take that information off of our system. But if he does not reply to any activity within 90 days, we do put him into what we call an inactive file. That file is in memoriam. The only way it comes off of our computer is that a person asks specifically to exclude it, take our form or our information out of the computer. The unions have asked us when a person has been, and we have knowledge of, that they have gone through a union hiring situation to remove that name from our computer. Most of our courses have been very, very successful, particularly this last year. We have an average completion rate and job referral anywhere from 64% to 93%. The Skills Center itself, 3 years ago, received a national award for being the most efficient skill set in the United States. Thank you.
I would like to reply to some of those statements. I didn't say that the training sessions were successful. What I was talking about was delays between finishing training programs and job placement. I knew of some cases that where there was some bad planning not to follow the state, but this was because of Alyeska's drawbacks and slowdowns, where some of the fishermen from Southeastern gave up a season of fishing to go to a training program, and it was 5 and 6 months after the training program before they were placed. They gave up a whole season's wages to go to that program, and then to wait that long is almost criminal negligence. So I think a system of OJT or open entry, open exit will relieve a lot of these programs. We get into double cost by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and other agencies, because when there's that many people coming into a union at one time, we cannot, no agency can support those people that long on supportive services. They have to send them back to the bush. So you've got the transportation out and then the transportation back, plus the supportive services again of 3 or 4 days before you can crank them out of the halls. And the costs are just outstanding. So I think there could be a little more coordination there and cut those costs in half, and we're going to have a heck of a lot more money for training. And that JAR system, 99% of the people that I put to work through our programs this summer, they're marked union right on the back of that 511, and it's admitted, so they're off of that JAR if you're complying with the union wishes.
Senator Rodin?
With the requirements of the federal law via the Alaska plan and the willingness of organized labor to dispatch or admit minority members in preference, it seems the training is the biggest drawback with a lot of 5,000 people in the rural areas of that 4,500 in training. How would you suggest the state expand in conjunction with Bradley Rand Alyeska training programs?
Your figures, that 500, that makes that, it was 500 in the Anchorage area qualified, approximately 500 in the Fairbanks area qualified. We're talking the craft skills. But when you get into the labor market, like I stated before, there's jobs on this pipeline where you don't look for the qualified person to fit the job, you look for the job to fit the person. And so I consider the 3,000 I've got in my bank actually qualified, if I had the job to place them in. A bulk cook job. How long does it take to train them to make a bed and mop a floor? A pick and shovel man, a drill operator, an oiler is an entry level. In every construction craft, there's entry level jobs. We've been doing it for years without training programs in most of them. And so when they say this qualified man thing, there are entry level jobs, and there always have been and always will be. When the son of a superintendent wanted summer work, he didn't go through a training program to go to work. He went to an entry-level position. And there are quite a few of those positions. People with you talk about line drivers, but how about manholes, bus drivers, fuelers, swampers in the Teamsters? All these entry-level positions. Mechanics helpers, oilers, general helpers and things like this at the 302 use. Carpenters helpers and laborers, or drillers helpers. There's a lot of jobs that are fairly simple entry-level positions that doesn't take that much training. It doesn't take a 6 month institutional training program to train that man. These should be OJT training programs for maybe a duration of 3-4 weeks where you use your money to match the employer's wages on a contributing basis. So he doesn't lose any of his production or profit by taking responsibility of training that man. I think it's more effective to train him that way.
Are you saying then that no training program is needed for Alaska Natives?
You've got crafts, so I'm talking entry level. Okay, you cannot train an OJT
CAT skinner because that CAT won't hold two people. You can't train OJT for a scraper because that seat won't hold two people. And it's pretty hard to train a good driller because you have to know that machine. It's pretty hard to do OJT train a powderman because you're going to kill some people. Pretty hard to do OJT. A lot of these more technical craft positions, and these have to be kept up.
What sort of numbers are we talking about with regard to minorities, and what sort of training program would you suggest for the various craft positions that might be open?
The ideal situation is the apprenticeship situation that the unions have. But these programs are fairly limited in numbers. We're probably talking between 5,000 and 6,000 people that are on our files now. And we heard from Alyeska and Bechtel that approximately 1,900 of these are working, so we've probably got 3,000 to 4,000 are left to be trained or placed on jobs. Now we're getting into marginal skill areas again because we've, as far as the northern area, I know this in the southeast area we've barely scratched the surface. And out in the chain, because I'm not too familiar with the numbers and the figures they've got down here because I don't get involved in it. But I think that the training programs have to be sped up a little bit, maybe redesign some to take some of the heat off the unions. And it's a very important field that the state is in because it's supplying work and utilizing this job force that has only been utilized by BLM, some of the agencies for the job here and there, and we're finding people out there that, heck, they make $3,000 or $4,000 a year. They've had a good year. This was a job opportunity that they were available to until this pipeline hit. And now you hear the cry out there, I want a pipeline job. But the state has never really gone into training like they have now. We've known this pipeline for a long time, and the state never geared up. In fact, the state hasn't, to this date, put one dime of state money into these pipeline training programs. It's all federal funds, every dime of it.
Mr. Williams, what kind of response are you getting from the state itself and local governments with regard to taking people aboard? What I'm thinking in terms of, and I hear this more and more, that as the pipeline workforce builds up, there are a lot of people that are leaving skills in the state government and various other areas to go to the pipeline, thereby leaving jobs open. Is the state and local governments cooperating with you to help, you know, your people get jobs here?
Okay, we've got a department within the Fairbanks Native Association that deals strictly with local job placement for natives. Because we've had this for about 7 years now, because the state couldn't deal with the minority employment problems in the urban area. We do job development, job placement, job counseling, and then job follow-up to make sure that this man can acclimatize himself to an 8-hour-a-day, 40-hour-a-week situation and be a successful employee. And this is still being utilized in the Minnesota. And we do have daily or weekly contacts with state agencies, local agencies, federal agencies, as far as job placement goes. But when you start putting that $10, $12, $14 an hour figure, $8 for a bull cook, we're having trouble in our own organization keeping people on board. Pipeline impact is here. In fact, some of the organizations I'm on, my standard motion is I move to adjourn until the end of the pipeline because your employee turnover is so fast and furious that everybody's having trouble keeping up.
Are there other questions? If not, then do you have anything further?
No, I think that's
okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. We'll go on then. Is Joel Lounsbury with LHD and Associates here? Okay, I'm seeing him. J.P. Jones, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Yeah,
could you, would you like to? Okay, we sure appreciate it. I'm sorry that the thing got to a crunch there.
My name is Blanche McSmith, and I was president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People for many years. At least I helped to organize it, and I am quite aware of the problems of the colored people in Alaska. Mr. Jones, both yesterday and today, discussed with me problems that they're having in the Fairbanks area, and also talked to the president of the National Association for Advancement of Colored People in Anchorage, and he expressed the same problem, that they are not getting a fair shake on the pipeline or any of the state jobs. They were discussing, I think Mr. Jones is a member of a committee that met in Anchorage recently, and he said that out of more than 7,000 state workers, there are only 179 Negroes hired. And he also told me that they've hired 390 since December, and only 8 of them were black. And most of the companies are not cooperating with Mr. Jones' activities, nor with Mr. Parks in getting Negroes hired. And so it is a dismal picture. And it isn't all. Now, they have a lot of old people in the people who haven't had the training, as you've discussed here, but could, of course, take jobs in the entry level. And then there are a lot of people who have the training, but they are being ignored. And it's a problem. I don't know. I wish Mr. Jones could have stayed. I know that I've had a personal problem myself the first time that I've had this kind of problem, and I know that I am qualified and trained, and I haven't been able to get a job. And I was let off from my job, and someone else placed on it when I was doing a good job. And I feel it was because I was a woman, and of course because I was black, and because perhaps of my age. So if this committee can do anything to help with the problems, there are great problems. I have, of course, I'm in a new situation. I'm usually on the side of championing somebody else whose civil rights have been infringed. And now I am trying, of course, to take my own situation and, of course, others, too.
Mrs. McSmith, we will be keeping the record open for 30 days. I will get a hold of Mr. Jones and have him get a written statement into us.
Maybe Mr. Parks, too, from Anchorage,
because
where the larger number of colored people live, is in Anchorage and Fairbanks.
Okay. And we'll get their statements, and we'll have it in the record. And I do want to apologize for not calling.
Well, he was very disappointed that he had to leave
sorry.
Without being heard.
Okay, are there questions for Mrs. McSmith? If not,
wait.
Representative,
you're speaking about 7,000 blacks. Is that for the state? Now you're talking about state employees.
Now, this is state employees. Some of the pipelines have hired colored people on the pipelines. They're working as bull cooks, waitresses, timekeepers. There are some equal opportunity persons on the pipeline. And so they have hired some blacks on the pipeline. But the figures I gave were figures that were given to me by Mr. Jones from Equal Opportunity Committee or something that he attended here just recently. And that was only state employment. And of course, most of those people are not in supervisory jobs. Most of them are in other types of positions.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
If not, thank you very much. Clarence Anioquia.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Clarence Anioquia, Area Director for the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Alaska. I apologize for being unavailable to present my testimony when previously called upon earlier by this committee. There was apparent misunderstanding as to our Bureau's participation, but be that as it may, I appreciate this opportunity to testify on behalf of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. My testimony supplements the testimony of Ms. Patricia Mayo, who presented the Department of Interior's position. The data relating to the Bureau of Indian Affairs activities were provided by my staff and incorporated in her testimony. In the interest of time, I will not repeat those data, but rather expand on a few items and finally offer a few comments and suggestions for your consideration. To begin with, I'd like to acknowledge the fact that, in our opinion, Alyeska is apparently meeting their commitment of native hire stipulated in the permit between them and the Department of Interior. Our Bureau is pleased to have participated with several other organizations and agencies in assisting Alyeska to meet this commitment. The progress of native hire to date, however, has not been an easy task to accomplish. Hopefully, through the cooperative efforts of all the parties represented at these hearings, we will be able to remove some of the barriers that exist that will clear the way for further progress. Our Bureau's objective in this effort is to provide as many employment opportunities to Alaska Natives as possible. Although we can be reasonably proud of the fact that we've assisted over 900 Alaska Natives to become employed to date, we also envision much difficulty in continuing this progress. We recognize the number of employment opportunities will drastically increase in the months ahead. If we are not able to resolve some of the basic problems that currently exist, employment opportunities available to Alaska Natives will be extremely limited. From our past experience, we have identified a few key problem areas that will hamper further progress. The first is that the 48-hour notice provided by the contractors to the referral agencies is very difficult to comply with. In most cases, it is not sufficient time for our staff and other referral agencies to make Alaska Native people available for placement. Most of the Alaska Natives that have been identified as job ready or training ready remain in their home communities. Logistically, it is nearly impossible to transport them to the point of referral in 48 hours in time to be hired. One approach to this problem has been to try to anticipate when job orders will be issued and bringing the people to Anchorage and Fairbanks in advance. In addition, many Alaska Natives come into these areas on their own in anticipation and hopes of being hired. Speculation and anticipation obviously has many pitfalls, which usually result in long waiting periods prior to placement, if placed at all. Our office has tried to assist individuals in this situation as much as possible through providing room and board and some temporary living expenses. Unfortunately, quite often this waiting period extends from several days to several weeks. In many cases, our funds and the individual's personal funds are depleted and the individual must return home, usually in frustration. The solution to this problem is not an easy one, obviously, as we can appreciate the problem from the contractor's point of view. One possible consideration that might be for the contractors to provide the referral agencies with a 1 week or 2 week projection of need. These could be recognized as projections only and not necessarily be binding commitments. The 48-hour actual requests could then be met more effectively with local hires. Another problem we are experiencing is a serious shortage of transit housing in Fairbanks. Although it hasn't been a serious problem in Anchorage thus far, we anticipate that it will become critical this summer. There's virtually no transit housing available in Fairbanks. At times, some of our employees are forced to house Native people in their own homes. Again, the solution to this problem is not an easy one. We would like, however, to discuss this in more detail with Alyeska and explore the possibility of housing the Transit Alaska Natives at Fort Wainwright. The final problem area I'd like to address is the difficulty in getting Alaska Natives dispatched to the job from the quote C list. This problem is not unique to Alaska Natives, as we recognize many other Alaskans in general are confronted with the same problem. It's frustrating for people to sit in the hiring halls day after day, waiting for dispatch, and seeing many other people getting hired. The solution to this problem perhaps lies in the local hire law. We recognize the question of legality and constitutionality of the one-year residency requirement. Not being an attorney, I cannot comment on the legality or constitutionality of this provision. My only hope is that this issue be resolved as soon as possible. If it is deemed legal, we can then implement it as soon as possible. If deemed unconstitutional, we can devise other methods of achieving the same objectives. In conclusion, I'd like to reiterate that it is admirable that the native hire provisions of the permit are apparently being met. It appears to me that our objective now should be to maintain that progress and perhaps accelerate it to the point that the goals of the Alaska Plan are also met. I believe they can be achieved through meaningful cooperation between the contractors, the unions, the state and federal agencies, and the referral and training agencies. If we view the past several months as being a testing ground, we should take time now to consider the problems we've all experienced, try to resolve them jointly, and hopefully pave the way for continued progress in the future. Our statistics indicate that there are approximately 400 to 500 job-ready Alaska Natives available for immediate placement. In addition, we estimate that there are 700 to 800 more available to enter pipeline-related training programs. We'd like to provide as many opportunities to these people as possible. Our Bureau is willing to cooperate with any organization that shares the same objective. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my formal statement. Several members of my staff from Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau are here with me today to assist in responding to any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Okay. Are there questions? Senator Rohde.
Reading the goals of the Alaska Plan, what number of Natives have been employed on the pipeline? And what is the percent also?
My area employment assistance officer has been working closely with us. Perhaps you need a direct answer.
The report that we get, the numbers of Natives placed on the pipeline is 1,911. And the percentage of Natives from anywhere from 1% to up to 15% as far as the Alaska Plan is concerned.
What is the final goal of the Alaska Plan? There is a higher percentage of Natives?
7%. I believe the final goal of the Alaska Plan itself, which is, has an 8-year duration on it, is 28% for Northern.
Thank you.
Representative Eliason?
I was wondering, Clarence mentioned today at least 900, and then prior to that, people were the first tax money. I think that they placed 900, and now you say a total of 911.
Okay, yes. The figure that we quoted in terms of a 900 plus that the Bureau of Indian Affairs assisted were almost entirely Bureau of Indian Affairs assisted only. I think we are not the only ones that have assisted in placing Native people on the pipeline. But as I understand, the total placement has been over 1,900, of which, like say, our agency has assisted better than 900 of those.
Are there any other questions? With regard to the Alaska Plan, could you enlighten us on what more perhaps we in the legislature could do to help in this area? I've heard grumbles that, you know, that there's no way to enforce some of the things that are required of the people connected with that plan. Could you comment on that?
I believe, Mr. Chairman, if you will, Mr. Rame is probably be in a better position to answer that, in as much as he works on that very directly.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is no enforcement
per se on the Alaska plan. You've got to recognize that the Alaska plan is a voluntary agreement between unions and contractors and the minority coalition. The only sanction that we can possibly place on anyone violating the or not meeting the compliance requirements of the Alaska plan is to place them in what is known as a Part 2 bidder. This requires contractors to have the minority percentages at each job site. Being a signatory to the plan, we allow them to spread the minority workers among all their jobs. But the federal mandate would require them to have the percentage goals at each job site. There's the only difference between Part 2 and a voluntary plan.
Okay. Were there questions? Any other questions? If not, then we want to thank you very much, Mr. Antioch. Okay. R.N. Chastain from Morrison Knudsen Company.
Just hired her.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Bill Hopkins, Alaska Oil and Gas. Eric Garnter, RCA, Alaska. Julius Kornfein, National Electrical Contractors. Well, I know, but I want to go to the question. Dave Roderick. Dave, you're last on my formal list. I guess somebody always has to be last. I can kind of explain very quickly what I mean. You know, there are 20 senators and 40 representatives, and when they issued the license plates, guess who was 61st? It was me. So
I don't mind bringing up the tail end here. I'm David Roderick, president of Pacific Rim. And we're running a small orientation school for native hire in Anchorage, Alaska, and we've leased some space at AMU. Last summer, I approached Alaska Pipeline on the concept that a 19 to 22-year-old native from a village might have some difficulty, who was not job ready, might have some difficulty getting into the economic stream, and we felt that a week to 2 week orientation course would be advantageous not only to the native but also from the turnover rate. Alyeska and our company negotiated for about 3 or 4 months and ultimately ended up with a curriculum that was usable and workable. And since that time we've had approximately 130 to 150 minority through this orientation school. I give you a little history to show that, at least from Alyeska Pipeline standpoint, their intent early on was to train and to do as good a job as they knew how in terms of making the native hire employable and lasting on the pipeline. They have financed us for a year, and contrary to some other testimony, by the way, to my knowledge, they have at least $1 million in the system of training that the Alyeska Pipeline has, have put it through the state. One of the first things that happened was a trade union organizer who was native went to Bethel and took a radio ad and said, all those people who wish to work on the pipeline, please sign up. He got 21 signatures, and I believe he went to BIA and asked them to transport them into Anchorage, and they showed up at our first orientation center. We had three almost journeyman electricians, two almost journeyman carpenters. We had one man who had spent 4 years running the Bethel substation, electrical substation. All of these people now were going through a basic orientation school and we're going to go to skill centers, Seward Skill Center, and the laborers to learn how to use a jackhammer. Well, I use this as an example of what did take place about October, and I'm sure you've heard about some of these things, and they are a lot smoother now, let me tell you. The second thing that I can tell you about was they had a course, I think it was our second course, of about 15, three native kids could not get flights into Anchorage to make the course on time. This native recruiter then found three blacks who had just recently arrived in Alaska, but feeling that he would prefer to have minorities start this training rather than either go back to the villages and wait for 2 or 3 weeks to get these three boys up. All three, by the way, I'm sure are going to make excellent workers, but they were not, quote, Alaskans in the true sense of the word. We are now, some 6 months later, dealing with the state on CETA funding. And we, generally speaking, get people who are who need the orientation, who are the paperwork has been done on, and things are